You're listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, or 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, or online at kpfa.org. The time is 1 p.m. Up next is Guns and Butter. Stay with us.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I take it the suggestion is we may have another massive terrorist attack. And certainly there has been a lot of discussion of that, perhaps as a pretext to attack Iran, perhaps as a pretext to institute martial law. And I must admit, this does worry me because I'm not sure that there is anything these guys wouldn't do to stay in power and to keep the lid on things.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. David Ray Griffin. Today's show, 9/11, The Myth and the Reality. Part 2. David Ray Griffin is an author, theologian, and lecturer. For the past several years, he has devoted himself to exposing the fraud of the official story regarding the attacks of September 11, 2001. In this definitive presentation, given on March 30, 2006, at the historic Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California, Griffin deconstructs 9 official myths regarding the events of that day. In part one, Dr. Griffin explored in depth the first 7 official myths, that American political and military leaders would not do such a thing, that the same leaders would have no motive, that an operation so big could not have been kept secret for so long, that the 9/11 Commission was independent, hence believable, that the Bush administration has provided proof the attacks were carried out by Al-Qaeda under bin Laden's leadership, that 9/11 came as a surprise to the Bush administration, and that U.S. officials have explained why the hijacked airliners were not intercepted. In part one, Griffin began to explore the 8th official myth, that official reports explain the collapses of World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7. We continue today's show, 9/11, The Myth and the Reality, Part 2, with a recapitulation of Myth 8.
I will discuss 9 of the major myths contained in the official story about 9/11. I will thereby show that the official account of 9/11 cannot be defended in light of the relevant evidence against the main alternative, according to which 9/11 was an inside job, orchestrated by people within our own government. I now turn to myth number 8. Official reports have explained why the Twin Towers and Building 7 of the World Trade Center collapsed. This claim suffers from the same problem as the previous one. We have had 3 official explanations, each of which contradicts the other, and none of which is anywhere near close to adequate. The first explanation, widely disseminated through television specials, was that the buildings collapsed because their steel columns were melted by the jet fuel-fed fires. But this explanation contained many problems, the most obvious of which is that steel does not begin to melt until about 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, while open fires based on hydrocarbons such as kerosene, which is what jet fuel is, cannot, even under the most ideal circumstances, rise above 1,700 degrees. A second explanation, endorsed by the 9/11 Commission report, is a pancake theory, according to which the fires, while not melting the steel, heated it up sufficiently to cause the floors weakened by the airplane strikes to break loose from the steel columns, both those in the core and those around the outside. All the floors above the strike zone hence fell down on the floor below the strike zone, causing it to break free. And this started a chain reaction so that the floors pancaked all the way down. But this explanation also suffered from many problems, the most obvious of which was that it could not explain why the buildings collapsed into a pile of rubble only a few stories high. The core of each of the twin towers consisted of 47 massive steel columns. If the floors had broken loose from them, these columns would have still been sticking up into the air 1,000 feet. The 9/11 Commission report tried to cover up this problem by claiming that the core of each tower consisted of a hollow steel shaft. But those massive steel columns could not be wished away. The definitive explanation was supposed to be a third one, issued by the National Institute for Standards and Technology, usually called NIST. The NIST report claimed that when the floors collapsed, they, rather than breaking free from the columns, pulled on them, causing the perimeter columns to become unstable. This instability then increased the gravity load on the core columns, which had been weakened by tremendously hot fires in the core, which NIST claims reached over 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. And this combination of factors resulted in global collapse. But as physicists Jim Hoffman and Stephen Jones have shown, this account is riddled with problems. One of these is that NIST's claim about the tremendously hot fires in the core is completely unsupported by the evidence or logic. A second problem is that even if this sequence of events had occurred, NIST provided no explanation as to why it would have produced global, that is, total, collapse. The NIST report asserts that column failure occurred in the core as well as the perimeter columns, but this remains a bare assertion. There is no plausible explanation of why the core columns would have broken or even buckled so as to produce global collapse. And this is only to begin to enumerate the problems in this theory, all of which follow from the fact that it, like the previous two theories, is essentially a fire theory, according to which the buildings were brought down primarily by fire. In the case of the Twin Towers, of course, the impact of the airplanes is said to have played a role. But most experts who support the official theory attribute the collapses primarily to the fire. NIST, for example, says that the main contribution of the airplanes, aside from providing jet fuel, was to dislodge a lot of the fireproofing from the steel, thereby making it vulnerable to the fires. By the way, when you go home tonight and light your fire in your fireplace, be sure to fireproof your steel, or the grate may collapse. But these fire theories face several formidable problems. First, the fires in these three buildings were not very hot, very big, or very long-lasting, compared with fires in some steel frame high-rises that did not collapse. A 1991 fire in Philadelphia burned 18 hours, and a 2004 fire in Caracas burned 17 hours without causing even a partial collapse. By contrast, the fires in the North and South Towers burned only 102 and 56 minutes, respectively, before they collapsed. And neither fire, unlike the Philadelphia and Caracas fires, were hot enough to break windows. Second, total collapses of steel frame high-rise buildings have never, either before or after 9/11, been brought about by fire alone or fire plus externally caused structural damage. The collapse of Building 7 has been recognized as especially difficult to explain. It was not hit by a plane, so the explanation has to rely solely on fire. And yet, because there was no jet fuel to get a big fire started, this building had fires on only two or three floors, according to several witnesses and all photographic evidence. FEMA admitted that the best theory it could come up with for this collapse had only a low probability of occurrence. The 9/11 Commission report implicitly admitted that it could not explain the collapse of this building by not even mentioning it. The NIST report, which could not claim that the fireproofing had gotten knocked off the steel of this building, has yet to offer an explanation as to why it collapsed. And NIST, like the 9/11 Commission, evidently does not want you asking why Building 7 collapsed even though it was not hit by a plane. On its website, it says that one of its objectives is to determine why and how World Trade Center Buildings 1, 2, and 7 collapsed after the initial impact of the aircraft, thereby implying that Building 7, like the Twin Towers, was also hit by a plane. In any case, a third problem with the official account of the collapses of these three buildings is that all prior and subsequent collapses, total collapses of steel frame high-rises, have been caused by explosives in the procedure known as controlled demolition. This problem is made even more severe by the fact that the collapses of these three buildings manifested many features of the most difficult type of controlled demolition known as implosion. I will mention seven such features. First, the collapses began suddenly. Steel, if weakened by fire, would gradually begin to sag. But as one can see from the videos available on the web, all three buildings are completely motionless up to the moment they begin to collapse. Second, if these huge buildings had toppled over, they would have caused enormous death and destruction in Lower Manhattan. But they came straight down. This straight-down collapse is the whole point of controlled implosion, which only a few companies in the world are qualified to pull off. Third, these buildings collapsed at virtually free-fall speed, which means that the lower floors, with all their steel and concrete, were offering virtually no resistance. Fourth, as mentioned earlier, these collapses were total collapses, resulting in piles of rubble only a few stories high. This means that the enormous steel columns in the core of each building had to be broken into rather short segments, which is what explosives do. Fifth, great quantities of molten steel were produced, which means that the steel had been heated up to several thousand degrees. And witnesses during the cleanup reported that sometimes when a piece of steel was lifted out of the rubble, it was dripping molten metal. Sixth, according to many firefighters, medical workers, journalists, and World Trade Center employees, many explosions went off both before and during the collapses. For example, Fire Captain Dennis Tardil, speaking of the South Tower, said, "I hear an explosion and I look up. It is as if the building is being imploded from the top floor down, one after another. Boom, boom, boom." Firefighter Richard Minasinski said, "It seemed like on television when they blow up these buildings, it seemed like it was going all the way around like a belt, all these explosions." Thanks to the release in August of 2005 of the oral histories recorded by the Fire Department of New York shortly after 9/11, dozens of testimony of this type are now available. I've published an essay on them, which is included in a forthcoming book on 9/11 and Christian faith, along with a lecture on the destruction of the World Trade Center, which I am now summarizing. A seventh feature of controlled implosions is the production of large quantities of dust. In the case of the Twin Towers, virtually everything except the steel, all the concrete, the desk, the computers, was pulverized into very tiny dust particles. The official story cannot explain one, let alone all seven, of these features, at least, as Hoffman and Jones point out, without violating several basic laws of physics. But the controlled demolition theory easily explains all these features. These findings are inconsistent with the idea that Al-Qaeda terrorists were responsible. Foreign terrorists could not have gotten access to those buildings for all the hours it would have taken to plant the explosives. Also, Al-Qaeda terrorists probably would not have had the courtesy to make sure that the buildings came straight down rather than toppling over. Terrorists working for the Bush-Cheney administration, by contrast, could have gotten such access. You're ahead of me here. They could have gotten such access, especially given the fact that Marvin Bush and Wirt Walker III, the president's brother and cousin, respectively, were principals of the company in charge of security for the World Trade Center. Another relevant fact is that the evidence was destroyed. An examination of the building's steel beams and columns could have shown whether explosives had been used to slice them, but virtually all of the steel was removed before it could be properly investigated, then put on ships to Asia to be melted down. It is usually a federal offense to remove anything from a crime scene, even a matchbook, but here the removal of over 100 tons of steel, the biggest destruction of evidence in history, was carried out under the supervision of federal officials. Evidence was also apparently planted. The passport of one of the hijackers on Flight 11 was allegedly found in the rubble. Having survived the fiery inferno, I'm not making this up. His passport had survived not only the fiery inferno caused by the airplane, but also whatever caused everything else in these buildings to be pulverized into tiny dust. The magic passport. To sum up, the idea that U.S. officials have given a satisfactory or even close to satisfactory explanation of the collapse of the World Trade Center is a myth. And these officials have implicitly admitted this by refusing to engage in rational debate about it. Michael Newman, a spokesman for NIST, reportedly said during a recent interview that none of the NIST scientists would participate in any public debate with scientists who reject their report. When Newman was asked why NIST would avoid public debate if it had confidence in its report, he replied, "Because there is no winning in such debates." In the same interview, Newman had compared people who reject the government's account of the collapses with people who believe in Bigfoot and a flat earth. And yet he fears that his scientists will not be able to show up these fools in a public debate.
You're listening to David Ray Griffin. Today's show, 9/11, The Myth and the Reality, Part 2. Dr. Griffin's presentation was hosted by Alan Michon of the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
In any case, I come now to the final myth, which is myth number 9. There is no doubt that Flight 77, under the control of Al-Qaeda hijacker Hani Hanyur, struck the Pentagon. There are, in fact, many reasons to doubt this claim. We have, in the first place, reasons to doubt that the aircraft that hit the Pentagon was under the control of Hani Hanyur. For one thing, the aircraft, before striking the Pentagon, reportedly executed a 270-degree downward spiral, and yet Hani Hanyur was known as a terrible pilot who could not safely fly even a small plane. Russ Wittenberg, who flew large commercial airliners for 35 years after serving in Vietnam as a fighter pilot, says that it would have been totally impossible for an amateur who couldn't even fly a Cessna to maneuver the jetliner in such a highly professional manner. Moreover, as a result of that very difficult maneuver, the Pentagon's west wing was struck. But terrorists brilliant enough to get through the U.S. military's defense system would have known that this was the worst place to strike for several reasons. The west wing had been reinforced, so the damage was less severe than a strike anywhere else would have been. This wing was still being renovated, so relatively few people were there. A strike anywhere else would have killed thousands rather than 125. And the Secretary of Defense and all the top brass, whom terrorists would presumably have wanted to kill, were in the East Wing. Why would an Al-Qaeda pilot have executed a very difficult maneuver to hit the West Wing when he could have simply crashed into the roof of the East Wing? A second major problem with the official story. There are reasons to believe that the Pentagon was struck only because officials at the Pentagon wanted it to be struck. For one thing, Flight 77, allegedly, after making a U-turn in the Midwest, flew back to Washington undetected for 40 minutes. And yet the U.S. military, which by then clearly would have known that hijacked airliners were being used as weapons, has the best radar systems in the world, one of which, it brags, does not miss anything occurring in North American airspace. The idea that a large airliner could have slipped through is absurd. Also, the Pentagon is surely the best defended building on the planet. It is not only within the P-56A restricted airspace that extends 17 miles in all directions from the Washington Monument, but also within the P-56B airspace, the 3-mile ultra-restricted zone above the White House, the Capitol, and the Pentagon. The Pentagon is only a few miles from Andrews Air Force Base, which has at least 3 squadrons with fighter jets on alert at all times. The claim by the 9/11 Commission report that no fighters were on alert the morning of 9/11 is wholly implausible, as I have explained in my book on this subject. The Pentagon, moreover, is reportedly protected by batteries of surface-to-air missiles, though if any aircraft without a U.S. military's transponder were to enter the Pentagon's airspace, it would be shot down. So even if the aircraft that hit the Pentagon was Flight 77, it could have succeeded only because officials in the Pentagon turned off their missiles, as well as ordering the fighters from Andrews to stand down. A third major problem with the official story is that there is considerable evidence it could not have been Flight 77 because it was not a Boeing 757. For one thing, the strike on the Pentagon, unlike the strikes on the Twin Towers, did not create a detectable seismic signal. Also, according to several witnesses and many people who have studied the available photographs, both the damage and the debris were inconsistent with a strike by a large airliner. That issue, however, is too complex to discuss here, as is the issue of what should be inferred from conflicting eyewitness testimony. Deferring those topics to another time, I will conclude by pointing out that the suspicion that the Pentagon was not struck by a 757, as the government claims, is supported by the fact that evidence was destroyed. Shortly after the strike, government agents picked up debris and carried it off. Shortly thereafter, the entire lawn was covered with dirt and gravel, so that any remaining forensic evidence was literally covered up. Also, the videos from security cameras on the nearby Citgo gas station and Sheraton Hotel, which would show what really hit the Pentagon, were immediately confiscated by agents of the FBI, and the Department of Justice has to this day refused to release them. If these videos would prove that the Pentagon was really hit by a 757, most of us would assume the government would release them. To conclude, it would seem for many reasons that the official story of 9/11, which has served as a religious myth in the intervening years, is a myth in the pejorative sense of a story that does not correspond with reality. One sign that a story is a myth in this sense, I have pointed out, is that it cannot be rationally defended. The official story has never been publicly defended by any member of NIST or of the 9/11 Commission or of the Bush administration. After Charlie Sheen had made public his skepticism about the official story, CNN's Showbiz Tonight wanted to have a debate about the points he had raised between a representative of the government and a representative of 911truth.org. But the producers reportedly could find no member of the government willing to appear on the show. In this unwillingness of the government to appear on an entertainment show to answer questions raised by an actor, we would seem to have the clearest possible sign that the government's story is myth, not reality. If so, we must demand that the government immediately cease implementing the policies that have been warranted by the official account of 9/11. When charges were brought recently against members of Duke University's lacrosse team, the president of the university immediately canceled all future games until the truth of the charges could be decided. But surely, as serious as the charges against some members of this team are, the charges against the official story of 9/11 are far more serious. For this story, serving as a national religious myth, has been used to justify two wars, which have cost many tens of thousands of deaths, to start a more general war on radical Islam, in which Muslims around the world are now considered guilty until proven innocent, to annul and violate civil rights, and to increase our military spending, which was already greater than all the spending of the rest of the world together, and yet now we've increased it by several more billions of dollars. Much of this being used to put weapons in space. Congress needs to put the implementation of these policies on hold until there is a truly independent investigation carried out by qualified individuals who are not members of the very circles that, if 9/11 truly was a false flag operation, planned it, carried it out, and then covered it up. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Dr. Griffin. This story has so many layers upon layers. He has several different presentations that I've heard him do, and there's so much material, it's just unbelievable. I have to say, something came to my mind the other day when we saw Andrew Card resign, or jump off the sinking ship, whatever you want to say. I've always thought, looking at that very, very famous footage of him bending over and whispering into the ear of President Bush in that Florida classroom, I've always thought that what he said was, "Everything's going according to plan, sir." It's the only thing that makes sense looking at his face, at Bush's face. Anyway, we have some great questions, and I know that there's going to be lots more coming up here. I will start with this one. How do you account for the fact that there are so many holes in the official story? Surely they would have planned the cover story while planning the attack. Do they want us to uncover the truth for some other reason?
That's a good question, and I devoted quite a bit of space to it in the new Pearl Harbor, because I point out there are so many things that are just so obviously problematic. But one answer is that, when you look at the war in Iraq, these guys are not geniuses. Now, there is a very frightening possibility, which is, yes, indeed, they do want Americans to know, and know that they know we know, and that there's nothing we can do about it, and that they're in control. I hope that is not the case, but it well could be. And people ask me if this stuff keeps me awake at night. That possibility does sometimes.
Is anything known about the placement of explosives in the World Trade Center buildings and their ignition?
Both Jim Hoffman, whom I believe is here, and Stephen Jones, a physicist at BYU, I think there was film with him in it, and he has written a lecture which has gotten a lot of circulation called Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Buildings Collapse? Both Hoffman and Jones have discussed this issue and, of course, would not know exactly. I mean, we won't know until the truth comes out exactly what happened. But there are plausible scenarios, not very difficult actually to figure out, as to where the explosives would have to be placed in order to slice, say, all the 47 core columns. And evidently it wouldn't take an enormous number of explosives. Jones at least suggests it would take quite a bit fewer than I had originally thought, so that it wouldn't literally take thousands of hours to plant all these. But I'm not an expert on this. If you don't know Jim Hoffman, come up afterwards and I'll point him out to you, and he can speak with some authority on this.
What about the flight that crashed in Pennsylvania? Several of my family members work for the NSA, and they say it was shot down.
I left 93 out tonight because I thought you might want to get home before midnight. But I devoted quite a bit of time to it, both in the New Pearl Harbor and in the second book. It certainly does appear that the U.S. military shot it down. I mean, there's an enormous amount of evidence that it did. And it appears that one of the motives for lying about when Cheney went down below is to make it appear that he could have not possibly given the shoot-down order. That is, everybody knows it was Cheney who gave the shoot-down order. Now, there's been the controversy, did he get the permission from the president? And, of course, they say he did, and even the 9/11 Commission expressed skepticism about that. But that aside, everybody knows that Cheney gave the order. So then the question is, when did he give the order? Every story prior to the 9/11 Commission report said that he gave it several minutes before 10 o'clock. And Flight 93 was shot down at 10:03, according to the government's theory, a little later, according to seismic records, or apparently. I mean, it's a difficult question. Richard Clark, for example, had said in his book, Against All Enemies, that he was amazed when he asked for shoot-down authorization, how quickly it came from Cheney. And Clark gives the impression it came about 9:45. And he says definitely before the president's plane took off at 9:50. And then we have reports that jets were sent by the head of NEADS, NORAD's in the northeast section, and told to shoot the flight down. We have a pilot who said he heard a rumor from his other people in the military that the military had shot down an aircraft. People at the site gave all sorts of evidence that would suggest the plane had been downed probably by a missile and so on. But the 9/11 Commission said that Cheney didn't get down to the underground bunker until almost 10 o'clock, and then by the time he gave the shoot-down authorization, it was after 10:10, so that at least 7 minutes had gone by after the flight had already crashed. So the logic is the military could not possibly have shot it down. But this is one of the most obvious lies in the commission report. Everything, including Cheney himself, indicated that he was down there long before that. And it's just amazing, or it ought to be amazing, that our mainstream press won't even point out that most obvious lie in the commission's report. Of course, another question is, why, if the military shot the plane down, why are they lying about it and saying they didn't? Why didn't they claim? Well, here, when we got a sufficient notification, we did our job. So see, we were trying to protect Washington. This is one of the big mysteries. Why they didn't take credit for it and lied about it. There are various theories about why this happened, and some of them are plausible, but I don't know for sure. One other thing happened recently, by the way. I better not tell this story because it's not clear enough in my mind, but it was a good one. Actually, it's coming back now. I can't remember his name. There was an envoy to Canada and talking to the Canadians about supporting America with regard to going all the way with the new plans for NORAD. And this speaker, to try to instill pride in the Canadians, said, well, you know, it was a Canadian who gave the order to shoot down Flight 93 on September 11th. So little bits of the truth do come out here and there, it appears.
You're listening to David Ray Griffin. Today's show, 9/11, The Myth and the Reality, Part 2. Dr. Griffin's presentation was hosted by Alan Michon of the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Has anyone studied who the passengers on the planes were and what happened to them, as it is suggested that the plane that hit the Pentagon was a missile?
Some people have done studies of the passengers. I have read those studies and find them quite intriguing, but I myself haven't really devoted enough time to this to talk with any authority about this. But as to the question of what would have happened to the passengers, say, of Flight 77, if something else, such as a missile or a small military airplane or something else still, was what hit the Pentagon, there are all sorts of possibilities. One was, announced that morning, was that an airliner had gone down on the Kentucky-Ohio border, and the FAA took this very seriously. And so that's one possibility of what happened to Flight 77. We won't know these things until we have a real investigation. But there are all sorts of things that then could have happened to the passengers. But I don't have any firm intelligence on this, so I won't try to speak to that.
What do you think is the best response to the phrase conspiracy theory?
Well, the quickest one is that the government's theory was the original conspiracy theory about 9/11. And it's very interesting that both President Bush and Philip Zelikow used the identical words, telling people, do not fall for outrageous conspiracy theories. But it's interesting to think about. what would be an outrageous conspiracy theory. It can't just be any conspiracy theory, since the government's theory is a conspiracy theory, according to which 19 Arab Muslims, under the inspiration of Osama bin Laden, conspired to do all these things. So what's an outrageous one? Well, you know, if you think about these things in terms of the philosophy of science, you have good theories and bad theories. There's nothing wrong with a theory, you know. Quantum theory is considered rather respectable, and yet it's a theory. And there's nothing wrong with conspiracy theories. We all believe hundreds of conspiracy theories. Every day you read the newspaper, read about, you know, it's just when two or three people conspire in secret to do something immoral or illegal, that's a conspiracy. And so our newspapers are full of those, from robbing the local 7-Eleven to Enron conspiring to cheat its investors. So there must be something that makes something an outrageous conspiracy theory. Well, in the philosophy of science, a bad theory, let's start with a good theory. A good theory is one that can take account of all the relevant facts in a self-consistent way. A bad theory is one that is inconsistent with some of the relevant facts. An outrageous theory would be one that is inconsistent with all the relevant facts, and that's the official theory about 9/11.
Is there any hope of getting these issues adequately addressed by the mainstream media?
Is anybody here from the mainstream media tonight who can speak to that? There was recently a report that there was to be a discussion, I believe a film and a discussion in Japan, Tokyo, I believe, and that the bureau chief for one of our major newspapers said that if he went to that meeting, he would be fired. I suspect this is true, that you are not, at least you are strongly discouraged from even attending such sessions to give them any credence whatsoever, any credibility, and certainly not to give a favorable report about them. Now, it does seem like things may be changing. For example, I know my own life the best, so I'll give a few examples. I did appear on C-SPAN a year ago, hooray for C-SPAN. Now, C-SPAN is not quite the mainstream media, but it's close. It has national coverage. So that was an important event. Then LA Times Magazine did a favorable interview with me. Another major newspaper, a major reporter for that newspaper, has done an interview with me. The photographer we've even sent, and I'm told that's a surefire sign the story's going to run, because they never waste money on the photographer unless it's going to run. It has not run. That was several months ago, but Rita and Katrina and lots of other things intervened. This reporter tells me he is still going to do the story. It could happen, and this could be a big event. So I am more hopeful than I was 6 months ago, and partly because I think our corporate owners of the media may be getting more and more convinced that what this administration is doing is not good even for corporate America, and might be ready, just as it appears that the elite in the country decided at a certain point that it was time for Nixon to go, and that's when the Watergate investigation was allowed to go forward. It may be that we're to the point where the wise men, now the wise men and women, will say they've got to go, and maybe 9/11's the best way to bring them down.
What organization bought the put options on United and American Airlines?
Well, of course the 9/11 Commission wouldn't tell you that, because you could go check the story out. If you read the 9/11 Commission report, people will say, oh, what a scholarly volume. Just look at those, 100 pages of notes in the back. But when you read the notes, you find that lots of things are missing, such as names anything where you could go carry out an investigation yourself. Another thing about this, while I'm on this, let me rant about this. As a professor who, you know, taught students, graduate students for a long time, what you teach them in writing a paper is you first do a review of the relevant literature. That's the first criterion for a scholarly approach to any subject. When the 9/11 Commission report was published, there had been about 10 books that had been published on this. My book, Hoffman's writings, several others, books from other countries. Not a single one of those books is even mentioned, let alone refuted. So it's not surprising they don't tell us who bought the put options.
If you believe that 9/11 is fixed, what do you see Bush doing in October 06?
I take it the suggestion is we may have another massive terrorist attack. And certainly there has been a lot of discussion of that, perhaps as a pretext to attack Iran, perhaps as a pretext to institute martial law. And I must admit, this does worry me because I'm not sure that there is anything these guys wouldn't do to stay in power and to keep the lid on things. But if I could offer one correction here, I don't think it's what Bush will do. I did mention who I think calls the shots in the White House.
Wasn't Rumsfeld quoted as saying something about the plane over Pennsylvania as being shot down?
That's right. That's one of the many things that seem to have slipped out, where he said, let's see, I'm blanking on the exact statement now, but it was something to that effect when he was talking about this. But yes, he evidently slipped on some other things too, but this was one of them. I think we all know this, that if we're trying to keep a secret and then we get in a tough situation, sometimes the truth slips out. And later we have to have our fixers say, oh, he didn't really mean that. But yes, he did.
To play devil's advocate, what can be made of the highly detailed report by Nova on the collapse of the towers? Are we to believe the good people of Nova are in league with the administration?
Well, I don't know the people in Nova, so I don't know if they're good people or not, actually. I assume there are some good people there, but and it could be that they were just good, naive people who believed what the administration told them, and so they put out a propaganda piece. I don't know. Again, with a lot of these things, there are all sorts of possibilities. And I haven't been one who has tried to, on many questions, develop a theory of what really happened, either on 9/11 or in the months before or in the months afterwards. So I don't have a theory about this either. But certainly the show is false. But what was the motive behind the false statements suggesting that the fire could have melted the steel? I don't know whether that was deliberate deception or just innocent ignorance.
Why have none of the four or possibly eight black boxes on the hijacked planes been revealed to the public?
I think that was a rhetorical question, so we can probably just move on. These black boxes could just reveal all sorts of things that contradict the official story. So we're not going to see these black boxes any more than we're going to see the videos from the Pentagon.
You're listening to David Ray Griffin. Today's show, 9/11, The Myth and the Reality, Part 2. Dr. Griffin's presentation was hosted by Alan Michon of the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Has anyone studied who the... Please comment on the allegations of war games in progress on 9/11 involving simulated hijackings as confirmed by Rumsfeld to Representative Maxine Waters.
People involved in the 9/11 truth movement some of us are generalists, but even generalists have to specialize in certain things. And I have followed the discussion of the war games with interest. At the time Mike Rupert wrote his book, I think he was talking about 4 war games going on. And now Paul Thompson and Matt Everett have suggested, I believe they're up to 9 now. What I found very remarkable was that during the 9/11 Commission hearings, somebody from the public asked one of the commissioners, actually Jamie Gorelick, why they didn't discuss the war games. And she said, we didn't go into that because we were told it wasn't important. So I took that as a good illustration of the way that Zelikow was able to... So the commissioners you saw on TV, they're not the ones who did the work. They just took the material that the staff prepared for them and then talked about it on TV. So they just either, again, with deceit or innocently, took what the staff gave to them, and in this case they were told it wasn't important. That said, let me add one more comment. I have not thus far been convinced that we should say that what happened on 9/11 was not a stand down, but was rather confusion caused by these war games and planes being out of town and all these blips on the computers and so on. It's possible, but I haven't seen the need for it yet, and so I'm still just an old-fashioned stand-down guy.
What do you think of the Moussaoui confession?
Again, I don't know what to think, but one question that has come up is whether that somehow contradicts anything that I've said tonight or in my other talks or books. Not at all. There are various possibilities. One is that a deal was cut, and he was maybe told, you're going to die anyway. So if you confess, we can take really good care of your families for the rest of your lives. Why not? Secondly, maybe he thought, I'm going to die anyway. Why not go down in history as somebody important, not just the fringe character who they were maybe going to use for something else? A third possibility was revealed on MSNBC, I'm told, a discussion between Dan Abrams and the NBC Pentagon, can't call his name, but anyway, the discussion was Abrams saying, well, isn't this surprising? This confession came out, and Porter said, yeah, we think he has a stun belt on. And Abrams said, what, really, a stun belt so they can just zap him if he doesn't say the right things? Well, I haven't directly seen it, but that was sent to me, and I have no reason to doubt it. Now, another possibility is that he's actually telling the truth, or what he thinks is the truth. That he really did think he was going to be involved in the operation and be involved in flying a plane into the White House. Again, that says nothing about what was really going on that day. In operations of this sort, you have patsies. Patsies are ones who are involved in an operation. They know they're involved in something, but they don't know generally exactly what they're going to be involved in. And they generally don't know they're going to be killed when it's all over. So they cooperate. So that's possible, too. So I really don't know what the truth is, but it, from my point of view, makes no difference to the story I'm suggesting tonight.
Why is a theologian one of the primary speakers for this cause? Do you see any religious or spiritual implications for 9/11? And what are they?
Your next visit.
Why is a theologian speaking about this? I didn't have anything else to do. Sure, and I think it was on the radio interview that was run here or in the paper. Anyway, what we theologians are supposed to be doing is trying to imagine and speak about the world from the divine point of view. And if the religions of the world are basically correct, the divine is the creator and lover of all peoples, in fact, all creatures, and cares about the good of the world, the long-term good of the world, and wouldn't want people producing nuclear wars that would decimate all life on the planet, wouldn't want the global warming to continue after 30 years after we've known about it, 35 years now, about the ecological crisis, wouldn't want all these things. So I'm convinced that this administration, as was said earlier tonight, is the most dangerous administration we have ever had for the future of this country. And the future of the world. And if trying to save God's planet is not a religious issue, I wouldn't know what was. Thank you for the question.
Why would Cheney have Flight 93 shot down, assuming a conspiracy was in effect?
That was probably asked before I gave my answer. So since I've already responded to that, my answer is, I don't know.
There are only a few demolition companies that could have pulled off a controlled demolition of the towers. Have they been investigated and individual workers sought out who might have been involved in the packing or placing of the explosives beforehand?
Of course not. Controlled demolition, that company, which is one of the few companies in the world authorized to do controlled implosions, was brought in to do the cleanup for the World Trade Center. I understand made quite a tidy profit on it. Tidy, not tiny. It's very interesting. Mark Loiseau, the president, did an interview recently in New Scientist magazine, and some very damning stuff in there, inadvertently. He explains that to make a building come down in that way, straight down so no other buildings are destroyed, you know, except maybe four other buildings of the World Trade Center complex, that you want to get rid of the whole thing anyway. And all the details. It takes enormous planning. He says he spends hundreds of hours when it's a big building, scoping it out, taking pictures, going back again. He says the explosives have to be placed just right and in precisely the right order in order to bring the building straight down. But then he says, oh, but of course the World Trade Center buildings were brought down by fire.
I agree with all you said. What do we do now? A, plan a revolution. B, nonviolent resistance like Gandhi. C, move to another country. They have the president, Congress, courts, military, CIA, NSA, Homeland Security, industry, media, etc. We have what?
Well, we have each other and we have the truth, for starters. And of the three options, I would say A and B, both of them, plan the revolution and nonviolent resistance. I gave a talk recently in Santa Barbara, which was actually the first talk I gave specifically as a Christian theologian speaking on this issue to fellow Christians. And in that talk, as well as in the book I mentioned that is coming out on 9/11 and Christian faith, I suggest that what we need within the Christian church in this country is an anti-imperial movement. Something like in Germany, a year after Hitler took power, there was a movement known as the German Church, the German Christians, which supported Hitler and thought he was their man who was going to bring him the kind of greatness Germany deserved. But another movement called Confessing Christians started with theologians such as Karl Barth and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And they argued that supporting Nazism is inconsistent with Christian faith. And so that even though on most political issues, Christians should have the freedom to believe and say what they want. On this issue, this should be made a matter of faith. And so this was an important movement. Of course, it didn't succeed. Bonhoeffer ended up dying for the cause. In South Africa, some of the churches decided that South African apartheid was so despicable, so contrary to Christian faith, that Christians had to call it a confessing situation, so that to be a Christian meant to oppose apartheid. So I believe that we are to that point in this country, and now tonight I would expand that and say that Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, ethical humanists, human beings should form an anti-imperial movement, because that's what, as I tried to make clear, 9/11 was all about, a means to increase the empire. And so we do need a revolution, a nonviolent revolution, against American imperialism before it's too late.
Listening to theologian, author, and lecturer Dr. David Ray Griffin from his definitive presentation, 9/11, The Myth and the Reality, delivered at the historic Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California on March 30th, 2006. Today's show has been Part 2. Dr. Griffin's books on 9/11 include The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, and the upcoming 9/11 and the American Empire, Intellectuals Speak Out, and Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11, A Call to Reflection and Action. David Ray Griffin's books are available at Amazon.com. DVDs of his lectures will be available at 911TV.org. Thanks to Hamook and Ken Jenkins for today's audio. Guns and Butter is edited and produced by Yara Mako and me, Bonnie Faulkner. To leave comments or order copies of today's show, call 510-848-6767, extension 628. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.net or visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.net.
Revolution, which is the evolution of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the...
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. The West Coast premiere of the second edition of Loose Change, open forum with filmmakers Dylan Avery and Corey Rowe in person, the film everyone is talking about, Tuesday night, May 2nd at 7 p.m. That's at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland. A $10 donation. This is going to be a benefit for Guns and Butter. Again, the West Coast premiere of the second edition of Loose Change with the filmmakers Dylan Avery and Corey Rowe in person. I hope to see you there on Tuesday night, May 2nd at the Grand Lake Theater. Tonight, the film festival continues at Humanist Hall, 7:30 p.m., with the showing of Arsenal of Hypocrisy, about the militarization of space and surveillance of the planet, with Bruce Gagnon. Also a showing of Battle for America's Soul, and that's about the dependency of Americans on the military complex for jobs. That's tonight, 7:30, Humanist Hall, Oakland. Admission is free.
The KPFA LSB will meet live in sunny San Jose, California, for our first regular meeting away from home. Join us Saturday, April 22nd at 12:30 p.m. at the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Hall, 420 South Market Street at East San Salvador, just 2 blocks south of the VTA Convention Center Light Rail Station, which serves Caltrain, Amtrak, and Santa Clara County.